Thanks for downloading this episode of Flush to Data,
the podcast which brings you all you ever wanted to know about toilets,
sewers,
wastewater science,
wastewater data, and the models we use to make sense of it all.
In short, the data generating process.
There's a reading list to go with it, and you can get news on our program if you follow us on Twitter at Flush2Data. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hi everyone, welcome to a new episode of the Flush2Data podcast. This is Chris Filet. I'm here together today with my co-host Jörg Rickermann. Hi Jörg.
Hi Chris.
And today we have our very special guest Linda Åhmont from Sweden. From the Stockholm area specifically. She will join us today to talk about the level of automation and wastewater treatment control today and other things just as well. So, Linda, thanks for joining. Hi.
Hi, Chris. Thank you.
So, Linda and I met, I would say, a long time ago. I'm guessing maybe 10, 12 years ago for the first time, probably at one of the ICA conferences. Focused on instrumentation control and automation, and at the time you were working on dissolved oxygen control or aeration control and wastewater treatment plants. You got your PhD from Uppsala University on that topic, and since then I lost a bit track of what you actually do. I know where you are, but maybe explain first how you got in the wastewater business. What was so appealing about urine and poo that you ended up here?
Yeah, it's a good question. You have to ask yourself that from time to time. Why do you do wastewater? But I really love it, for the first thing to say. I was doing my master's in Uppsala. I was doing environmental and aquatic engineering as a student. I took a year off to try out some different jobs and just take a break. And when I was starting my studies, I thought I was going to work with climate change, because early on I had picked up that this was coming on, and I wanted to sort of get an engineering degree with an environmental profile so that I can do some job there. But during my studies, I ended up doing some work within wastewater during this year off. And I realized that this is a place where everything meets. You have all the different technologies. You have chemistry, biology. You have the environmental impact, which drives you. But you also have interesting aspects of law and economy, and also heavy engineering in terms of tunnels and infrastructure and so on. So I understood back then during my time off studies that I should do wastewater, and that's also when I started working at IVL, the Swedish Environmental Research Institute. I also wanted to devote it to working with wastewater, but also data, since I started to working on that early on. And then I did my PhD, and after almost 10 years at IVL, I moved on to Käppala, where I'm now, Käppala Wastewater Treatment Plant here in Stockholm.
Very good. So IVL is kind of a special institute, I would say, a unique structure relative to how things are organized in other countries. Could you maybe explain a bit how IVL works and what it does?
Yeah, it's quite an old organization. It was started up in I think it was already in the 60s and 70s, it started working with environmental questions. And it's also always had a strong relationship to the industrial and environmental questions, but always been adding on with different aspects of environment, and also working with wastewater questions for quite a few decades now. And it's a combination of doing research and consultancy, which I liked a lot. And when it comes to research, it's the common questions. You get your finance from sending in applications, both nationally, but also, of course, internationally. And then also working with different parts of society to solve environmental questions very broadly, I would say. And they also had a group quite early, already in the late 90s, I believe, that was working with data and digitalization, even though that word didn't really exist. And it was into that group that I was recruited after my studies. And that group really early on worked with wastewater and water questions. So that's sort of also why I was doing my PhD in that area.
I like what
so
you
it's not a university,
that,
but...
Yeah, sorry. Like I didn't want to interrupt. Sorry.
No, you're, go ahead, please.
I like where you said in wastewater, everything comes together, right? Like the biology and the chemistry, but also like physics and engineering. Yet this data aspect, like what we are seeing now, is relatively new. Although like wastewater treatment plants had been checked for compliance and had to do a lot of monitoring, like always, I guess, right? It just was evolving. Can you maybe describe like what was your first contact with data in the modern sense, let's say online sensors or databases, like really massive historical data?
I think that was already during my master studies at Uppsala University. Both in when doing courses in empirical modeling and control with Bengt Karlsson, who was also my supervisor in my PhD later on, we came in contact with the wastewater application in those courses. But then I also did my master thesis at the Uppsala wastewater treatment plant and evaluating a process stage at their plant that had been in operation for 10 years. And the question was basically, okay, so how is this process stage performing? And then you start asking yourself, okay, where's the data to tell me how it's been performing? And then I came in contact with PCA, principal component analysis, and starting working with that in MATLAB and trying to having to organize the data and do the data quality checks and so on in my master thesis. And that's also how I came in contact with IVL, since they had been working on that in wastewater doing PCAs before and having some reports on that. So that's when I actually remember quite early on in my thesis work, I was asking one of the operators at the Uppsala treatment plant, so what about these sensors and what do they do? How good are they? And he just looked at me and was one of these senior operators telling me there's never a true measurement. You can never trust a sensor. And so that's how it went on, I guess. It was a really good advice he gave me.
Mm-hmm. We have a colleague at AELWAC that never trusted pipettes and wrote a whole report about pipetting and all the confounding factors. So that's another piece of advice. Don't trust your pipette. But yeah, data quality issues, they arrive in all elements of the data generating chain. Could you tell a bit more about what you do now? You have a unique title, I find. Your job title is rather unique, and maybe you can explain a bit what it means.
I'm supposedly a production manager.
On a wastewater treatment plant, that's very good.
Yes, exactly. We have a very fancy raw material at this place. No, I mean we're a producing industry. We're producing clean water and sludge for farmland and a lot of biogas for the buses here in Stockholm. So, but essentially the department that I'm working with, we're doing all operations of this treatment plant and some of our outer facilities as well, the maintenance, and also process monitoring and process development in connection to the plant. So it's quite broad, and you also see many examples of how data is used, of course. Mm-hmm. And also from my background, I very much like that I have the automation control system under the roof of the department, of course. Since it's still something I like to think about sometimes.
So when I started my PhD, the way we thought of the Nordic countries when it came to wastewater treatment control was that was kind of the place to go. The, not only was there excellent research being done, there were plenty of plants that were taking on the lead on implementing new controllers. At the time, ammonia-based feedback control was kind of new and being piloted in plants all the way throughout the Nordic countries, I think. Is that a particular explanation you have for that? Why? I mean, is it correct that you know, these are leading plants and leading industry in Europe, let's say? And how do you reflect on that?
That's an interesting question. Being sort of used to the way we do it here, I can't say how you do it otherwise, but I would say that automation is something which it's something that we appreciate a lot. Maybe it's because we have like an industrial tradition. I mean, we're here at Sheppala, we're using the ABB control system, and I mean, it's developed close to here. We have also a tradition in the engineering departments to educate engineers in control. But maybe also, I mean, it follows the effluent criteria. I mean, it's the driving force for implementing control. And in the 90s, when nitrogen removal was introduced, and there was also dissolved oxygen control already then, I mean, then it was a natural step to take to implement control on ammonia, since that was connected to the effluent criteria. And I know that even though I wasn't around by then, I know that in around 2000, when the finalization of the reconstruction of Sheppala treatment plant for nitrogen removal was finalized, they took a decision to automate the whole plant. Everything should be run remotely. And this is 20 years ago. And of course, when you take such a step, that also other steps will follow. I mean, you need to trust the sensors if you're going to do a remote control of operations. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what's really driving it here, but also, I mean, I know also Denmark has been really early on developing control and implementing control. And I mean, there's also been a business perspective on that in Denmark. They have companies, a lot of companies doing that. Yeah, so I think that we're quite digital in general in the Nordic countries. But I can't really compare since I'm so used to it, I guess. So maybe do you have a?
No, I think it's difficult to pinpoint one cause. I think there's some leaders, I think, that have are visible across Europe as leaders in this technology area. But I think the point about the regulators imposing certain constraints and that then motivating adaptation or adoption of technology makes a lot of sense. I don't want to say it's this or that. I think these are interesting points when it comes to technology adaptation.
When you're looking at phosphorus, for instance, we have quite low limits on phosphorus compared to other countries. Mm-hmm. And that's also challenging. You really, really need to look at optimization when you're trying to pick those final percentage in your treatment.
Yes. Can you explain that to me? Why do you have like so low standards because of all the lakes?
No, I'm not the right person to answer that. I think it's coming down to the regulators how they decide to put the limits. But I don't really know the background.
Yeah, an interesting point to that, and I think in Switzerland the attention to phosphorus has been limited historically, I think. And I think it's now changing because people are looking at phosphorus as a resource. But I remember one student once saying, oh, I went to this nutrient recovery conference and I was surprised to learn about biological phosphorus removal. So apparently this student had never heard about the option to remove or capture phosphorus in that way. And for me, it highlighted that, oh, that's interesting how this is completely off the radar for at least some of the students at AOAC. So again, it points to the regulator as a source of, let's say, pressure to take on new technologies and develop new technologies. Good. Yeah, thanks for that. I think it makes sense.
Yes. One thing I would like to hook up on is that you mentioned from your master study, right, on this Uppsala plant, like never trust a sensor. That was like one of the key messages. And now you talk about fully automating a plant, right? And that's only possible with sensors. Yeah. Can you maybe like explain that a little bit? Has something changed? And like if we talk about sensors and you are responsible to document the performance and the compliance of a plant, what is your favorite sensor at the moment?
Okay, so yeah, well, there's certainly been a development on the sensor side. The accuracy of the sensors and so on it's been improving. But still, I mean, it only has to be as good as it has to be. If you're doing control and monitoring remotely, as long as you're aware that it's not a perfect signal that you're seeing, it can still be useful. And that applies now, and it applied 20 years ago. It's only that we have better ways of actually knowing more now. And it's also something that we need to see more of also in the future. I mean, we are planning to invest in more sensors the coming years because we are having even more stringent effluent criteria. I've been working so much with ammonia in my PhD, but I think here as a plant, I do like the phosphorus measurements when they work. And I'm also looking forward to see if we can develop that more. And I'm really hoping that the manufacturers can trigger this development. We're in a couple of years, we'll be running the plant towards below 0.20. That's the new requirements. A few years from now, when the load is increasing, we'll be even more restricted, since we're not allowed to treat. As the load goes up, the concentrations have to go down because we have a mass of phosphorus which we can't be above. Mm-hmm. And then we will be even pushing even lower.
Yes.
So I'm not saying I have a favorite sensor at the point, but maybe this is my favorite focus.
Yes.
When it comes to measuring, because I think nitrogen, that's okay with the sensors that we have or the equipment that we have.
Mm-hmm. Yes. No, I was not looking for a specific brand. You know, I was just whether it's an iron selective electrode or like an optical device which like gives you a full spectrum of the wastewater, like something like this, right? Mm-hmm. And I was more getting for evidence or operational convenience, right?
Well, from a permit point of view, the evidence will be from a lab sample. So in that sense, like the ion selective sensors or the optical sensors, as long as you have like a quick response and having it in the right place and can trust it enough, I mean, it's a really big help.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's something that... that really has been improving like the last decade.
That's an interesting point. So the phosphorus measurement, that would be an analyzer, right, for total phosphorus. And in the lab, you basically apply the same measurement principle. I think it's the same, usually the same colorimetric measurement. So would you see any movement on the regulator side where they say, okay, now we can trust the online analyzer, because it's basically the same as in the lab. Mm. Do you think that's an argument a regulator could be open to?
Not that I heard of. I guess in Sweden, we're doing the measurements, both sampling and the analyzing ourselves. It's not done by the regulators or anything. It is different in different countries. And I haven't heard any movement towards sort of making this a bit more liberal and possible to mm-hmm. do on spot with the analyzers. Mm-hmm. No. From a theoretical point of view and measurement principle point of view, that's an interesting thought.
Yeah, you could argue that taking a grab sample, taking it to the lab, then preparing it manually there, doing the analysis manually there, causes more measurement uncertainty than an online, a well-maintained, well-positioned online analyzer would. But there's certainly people, especially on the sensor sales side, that would argue that their sensors are better than the lab. Are these the kind of discussions that you have on a regular basis?
No, I haven't run into them.
Okay.
I will look out for it. No, but I mean, it's true. I mean, as all kind of handling of a sample poses a risk to the outcome of the actual measurement. So, I mean, to keep the quality, I mean, you really need to quality check all stages. So, as mm-hmm. long as you quit a stage, that's one risk less.
Yeah. One of the interesting things that you can learn from a graph is whether people put the lab measurement on the x-axis or on the y-axis, and the sensor value on the x-axis and the y-axis. And from that, you can tell which one they prefer.
so what do you do, Chris?
Well, I'd say it depends. I'm aware of both perspectives. And, I think it's interesting you bring up PCA, because PCA allows to account for measurement uncertainty in both, which would be my preference. But traditionally, when people do linear regression for calibration, you either explicitly or implicitly assume that one is trusted and measurement are error-free, and the other one has the measurement error. And then, obviously, because you put in linear regression Y against X, traditionally at least, you know what the implicit bias is in that particular person, or implicit, or maybe it's not a bias. Maybe they have the right perspective. That's interesting. I've actually come across a few conversations where people are no, the lab is wrong, my sensor is right, there's some interesting developments there. Some people are advocating for data as a service model, where basically mm-hmm. you as a plant or as a manager are not responsible anymore for the data quality. It's something you basically buy as a service from somebody else. And then if for some reason the measurement quality wasn't appropriate, you can sue them basically, right, for delivering the wrong data. Is there any talk about that, or is that silly?
No, at our organization, it hasn't been up. I think that we're quite proud of having control of the data quality ourselves and all along the chain and quite broadly among the organization. And I think it's something that also means that we have a good enough trust in our data, even though we're aware that it can always improve and it's never perfect and all that. Having control of your data and doing all the checks and having control of all the steps and so on, it's also a way of improving your work in general. It doesn't only apply to improving the data. It can also actually improve the process and the process outcome itself. Mm-hmm. Because as long as you dig into the data I mean, you mentioned PCA, and I mean, it's really a way of finding correlations and finding finding different stages in the process behavior and so on. You can easily connect it to what's going on out there in the process. So I mean, if you can, you can of course have a service doing all this, but I think you're also will be losing like a connection to the process and or the equipment for that matter. I mean, there's a lot of data that we're handling that's not only process related and or online sensoring, IEC sensors and so on. And a lot of our data that we're collecting and storing is also from our equipment, mechanical equipment, electrical mm-hmm. equipment, and so on. Mm-hmm. And I think you need to get to know your equipment and your process, and even though you might have it as a service, you still need to have this knowledge of how things operate. Keep them as friends.
It seemed very interesting that you mentioned that. Like, I just yesterday saw an advertisement of like some fancy service company who said that most businesses are only using 10% of the data they collect, right? Like when the blower switches on, like when the pump is, like the pump cycles, for example, all this kind of stuff is recorded somewhere, but mostly not used, I guess. Are you looking a bit deeper into the routine data you collect? And maybe in general, like, what are you doing with the data so far?
Well, if we start with the now and what we're doing now with the data, I think a key point in time each week is the process meeting that we have on Fridays. Mm-hmm. And that's very, very much based on data from the previous week. And we gather people from operations, the lead operator for the week, together with process engineers, development engineers, managers at different levels, lab staff, and maybe importantly, we also have the instrumentation staff there. Mm-hmm. And it's a quick meeting every week, maybe 20 minutes, and we go through. I mean, if you look at the data that this meeting is based upon, and all the performance indicators and the also raw data sometimes, but also averages and so on, mm-hmm. that are up there. It's a lot of data that we together have a look at. And that's I think that's it's been done for years here, and it's a really good place to sort of use the information that you get. People can ask questions, tricky problems or something, planning can be brought up and so on, and you can connect what's happening in your data with what's happening in your process and in the operations. Mm-hmm. And the process engineers, they're key in looking at the data, and they're in close connection with the instrumentation staff. They're actually in the same group, and I mean it's a lot of part of the job is to have a look in the databases and in the different overviews that they've been creating with checks about how the plant is running. So that combined with what the operators do in the control system every day, I mean, it's the basics of from day to day what's going on with the data. And on top of that, it's the formal reporting that's really we have to do, both internal reporting of some kinds and quarterly reports and so on, but also the external reporting to, it's a lot of reporting that has to be done from everywhere to the EU, to the local authorities and national mm-hmm. authorities as well. I think that the discussions that I've picked up lately, it's a lot about the metadata that you like so much, Chris. Now it's...
Well, the lack thereof has been a challenge, yeah.
I think that there is a risk that these 10% that you mentioned, Jörg, that will be decreasing. That number, and probably not because that, but because we're using less data or less information from the data, but that the amount of total data is keep increasing.
Okay, now I get it. So you say you don't do less with the data, but like there will be so much more
because each
and every pump will be, have a temperature sensor and a vibration sensor and all kind of other things, which then will just inflate. Okay, that's very, very, it's very interesting. And I'm...
Related to that, so one person once told me, if nobody's looking at the data produced by a particular sensor, you should remove it or switch it off. And I wonder what your take is on that, Linda.
I would say principally, yes. I mean, I heard someone mentioning sort of the sensor or data graveyard as a place where, or a group of sensors which you don't use and you don't know even know which signals they're brought up in or if you can trust them or not. And if you keep doing that, you really decrease the trust in the whole, not only those sensors, but also other sensors or instruments. So it's not really a good idea to just go along and not do anything about it. Bring it up, move them if you don't trust them or find a solution. That's my principal answer. But of course, there will always be sensors that you just can't take care of at the moment, and you're waiting for them. You're waiting to find a time to handle. But I think also that the,
I think your Friday meeting that you just described achieves exactly that, right? You look at the data with a particular purpose, of course, but that's probably about the best way to assure data quality remains at the required level, you know, by actually looking at the data together from different angles. That seems like a very sensible approach. Because I think the automatic fault detection methods, as fancy and as advanced as they are, I don't think of them as a replacement for the human eye. It's very difficult to reach that level of quality with automatic checks, I think. Good.
I think on the process monitoring side and data, I mean, I think we still develop how we work and we still want to improve. But I think the next step will be to move on towards the more mechanical and electrical equipment and look at the data from in the point of managing our resources and equipment in the right way. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of money to be saved. I think you can increase stability and reduce process risks that way. But I think we're still learning. And the wastewater utilities, they're not unique here. I mean, you have the similar challenges in other industries where you have a lot of equipment. But I'm curious to see where we can go there. And also, I mean, with new intelligent communication protocols and new electrical equipment that can actually communicate other kinds of data from what kind of status you have, I mean, that's still developing a lot compared to before.
Good. So I think we reached the point for a little break.
Small break, yes.
A small break.
Have a sip from your coffee cup. Buckle your seatbelt.
Yeah,
exactly.
Sounds good.
So here are some questions for you, Linda, to get to know you better. So I'll give it a start. How about ABBA or Opeth?
ABBA or
Opeth.
Oper.
Both are Swedish bands.
ABBA or... Can you say the other one?
I think we know the answer. You write it O-P-E-T-H.
Okay, so now that's your band talking, right?
Not my band. One band in from Sweden.
I just get so like Google interested now.
Well, check him out. Maybe next time you'll change your answer.
So let's ask him back. What do you prefer, Chris?
Oh, I'm going for Opeth, always. Opeth.
Okay, so it's totally unknown to me, but that's like, I think, one of these fun, part of these silly fun questions. So like exactly. A more mundane question, like for the layman out there, feed forward control or feedback control?
You should always start with feedback control.
I hear a bit of Gustav in there.
Of course you do.
Next one, Uppsala or Chapala?
Oh, Chapala.
Utility, why? Utility or consultant engineer?
Utility.
Oh, okay. Can you say why? Because I think like we always had the discussion among the PhD students when we were like doing our research where we would go to have the biggest impact, right? You could do research, you could go to industry, or you could go to a regulator, right? But like industry was mostly consulting, and like the utility was, yeah, they do their thing, right? Not innovative, and it's always the same. So you say utility. Can you say why?
Well, first of all, I was an industrial PhD. So when I was doing my PhD, I was doing like research consultancy at this, well, for some years as well. And I think it has a lot to do with the timing. We're doing our third technology shift here, the coming 10 to 15 years. We have so many things that are happening at the same time. We're also part of the development of society that will sort of outlive myself. And as a consultant, of course, you contribute to this as well. But at this stage in my career, at least, I feel that the long-term questions that we're struggling with and that we're working with, I mean, I really enjoy taking a part in that. So that's why I'm saying right now Chapala and right now utility.
Very good. Then let's do one more. Meshuga or Tyrion?
I only know a Meshuga, so I guess I say that.
That's good.
Not bad.
Yes. Now for something very different, separate or combined sewer systems?
Oh, well, since I said Chapel and Utility before, I should, of course, say separate to reduce the non-review water.
Good. One more. Let's say arch enemy or Lordi?
Lordi? How do you define that?
So Lordi was a band that entered the Eurovision.
Oh, it was the Finnish Eurovision. Okay.
The Finnish.
Of course, I vote really? For them. It's the neighbors. And I love their costumes.
Yes. So
you got one more?
Yeah. I have one more, yes, like for oxygen sensors. Optical or Clark membrane?
Oh, it's a tough one. It depends. I say optical.
Why does it depend?
Well, we did a study at IVL that Oscar was also involved in that we talked about before, where we could see that they were the optical and the other sensors, they weren't comparable at different situations. But I mean, I like the idea of not touching what you're measuring. That's cool. But why do you, I mean, you really like to combine the music here.
Yeah, well,
that's,
was like,
that's just us. That's our personal bias.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's like we are going to unveil this in like one of the future episodes where we interview ourselves. We're just like postponing it, like to not like shoo away the listeners, you know. So basically, it's because we are playing music in like a couple of bands, and like we like the same stuff. So like we thought nobody on this earth is combining wastewater and guitar music. So why not? Like,
exactly.
And that's like, it's a residue, I would say. Like,
yeah. Yes. Yeah. I'd say we've gotten some surprising answers, some funny answers. So.
My connection to music is from my childhood and the violin. So if I would ask you a question, I would ask you klezmer or Irish folk.
Can you say that again? What?
Klezmer or Irish folk music.
Oh, that's a difficult one. That's difficult. Yeah.
Well, send them in. I'll ask them to you.
Well, if you press me on the one, like I would say Irish, like in the early morning hours, and klezmer, like for music theory type of stuff, you know, for the harmonics,
uh-huh.
I would say. Yes. Very well, very well. Like.
Good.
Yes.
All right. Then, okay, one last one. PID control or fuzzy control?
Well, I must say PID control. But fuzzy control, I mean, that's okay.
we just let it stand there, right? Like, thanks. Good. Take a deep breath. Now we're going for the second hour. we could definitely go on, but like time is limited, so I would like to come more to like the part where we stopped, right? Like we have a lot of data, and if I understood it correctly, you use it for operational stuff, like a bit of planning, and like a big motivation is the compliance assessment, right? So these three pillars, so to speak. And most of the analysis you do is like traditional stuff. But now we're entering this digital age where everything is smart, right? And like we have some people who claim or who like the slogan bullshit in, value out,
mm-hmm.
Like to mimic this Bebo concept. But like if you could make a wish, right, like for something which would happen, like to prepare for this weekly meeting, which is not taking so much time or which is being done reliably, like what would that be?
Reliably and automatically.
Yes, by like, let's say a machine.
Yeah. I still would, I probably still would go down to working with the data quality in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I think for the weekly meetings, I mean, that's a checkpoint on where we're standing, how we're doing, what it looks like, mm-hmm. Do we have a shift somewhere, what's the data compared to last week and so on. So if you're looking at that time span for like the Friday meeting, that would sort of help out in putting a bit more trust into the values that you see.
Mm-hmm.
But then I see if you look at another time span, like more than like the daily, as you said, the daily operations and so on. I definitely would like to see more decision tools to help decisions mm-hmm. in a daily basis that you can trust enough to evaluate how they're doing, help you out to make sometimes quick decisions, to manage to save resources. Not having to keep everything in your head at the same time, and so on, and perhaps one or two of these tools could qualify into going live and going in feedback, mm-hmm. going into control.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it depends on where you're standing. Are you doing your annual report, or are you doing your weekly, monthly check, or if you're standing mm-hmm. there and looking at all the trends at the same time as an operator? It has different perspectives, so it comes down. It's about the why. It's always about the why. Why do you need this measurement? To what quality do you want this to be reported?
Mm-hmm.
What should mm-hmm. this tool do? Why do you need to use this digital new technology? And it's sometimes it's the other way around. I know, Chris, that you also listened to Oscar's defense, mm-hmm. PhD defense, and I believe he brought up the solutions looking for a problem problems looking for solutions. And when it comes to these digital tools, you really need to understand the problem first.
I think
that's my point of view.
No, and I completely agree. There's a lot of excitement, of course, because it's getting cheaper and cheaper to measure things. The sensors that we already had are getting better. But I think it's generally wrong to say we're going to measure just because we can. You need to know why you're interested in a particular source of information. But I think, to me, it points us back often to the regulator, is that that the purpose of measuring is often to respond to a regulatory requirement, either because you simply ask to report something or because you have to satisfy a constraint or minimize or maximize a particular objective. And I agree completely with you. The regulator has a key role there, and will be a major factor in determining what will be measured, and which measurements will be checked carefully, and which ones will not be checked carefully. Mm-hmm. The question of why is so important and often missed, and you see this with students. I think that. They want to do good in the world, you know, especially environmental engineers tend to have this tendency to more than others, I would say, to make a better world, or make the world greener and environmentally more safe. And then they learn about machine learning, which is really great and fantastic, and there's been great breakthroughs in machine learning, of course. And then they want to combine the two. But then the part where, you know, what is actually motivating the use of this tool can easily be skipped in the hype surrounding machine learning and sensing. It's surprisingly common, and it's not only the case for environmental engineering, I would say. I have now a bit of experience outside of environmental engineering, energy systems and manufacturing. And the exact same thing happens there. In one case, cameras, for example, have become incredibly cheap, especially infrared cameras. And what you see now is people are installing them all around and everywhere, and not always knowing why or what they're going to do with those data streams. And it's amazing because in some cases, we're thinking about storing or capturing 12 terabytes per year, which for a research project is not a small amount. So that leads to a particular, you know, we have to invest in a particular infrastructure to store and manage the data, to, you know, not only ingest it into a database, also for querying it out of the database. The metadata, like we briefly discussed, we need to know where the camera was, because some of them are moving around in a 3D space. So we need to know where it was at which time, what it was looking at, and so forth. All that investment in metadata, I'm sometimes worried that if it's not clear what kind of research question we're going to ask, it's going to be, you know, a lot of data for nothing.
Yes.
And I don't mean to say it's always the case, but it's a question and I have to bring up surprisingly often, because it's not.
And it's also a question about
clear from the beginning.
Yeah, it also comes down to what's actually real innovation. I mean, you can innovate, but when it's not used, you have a cost for development. But if you're developing something, it could be the cameras and the terabytes. It could be a model which you calibrate and it looks great. It all comes with a cost of maintenance in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it's digital, it's still digital maintenance. I mean, you can't just leave it there and just trust that it will be working or that it doesn't come with a cost at the end. And that's something that I think when you're early on in a stage and developing something, you often forget the how it's going to be maintained in the long run and the cost that's coming with that. So I guess as further we go along with finding new, hopefully useful tools, you still have to sort of add like a digital asset management dimension to the whole system and model and data area.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, one thing, if you allow me, Chris, is like we've been talking a lot on the data itself, the raw data, and you mentioned now the modeling part, right? And like maintaining these models. You've been talking about like statistical models, like this principal component analysis, but often people also use domain process-based knowledge, right? And we go in the direction of applying them live, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Like, are you thinking about that and like about the other models, right, which you may develop in-house and have to maintain? Do you see that you might be employing a data scientist in the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, following the tradition that I was also part of the PhD students that we've been working with now for a few years, we actually have a PhD student together with two other utilities working with development of digital twins and going live with them. So that's what we're doing in terms of using the models live. We're also looking into using an influent model also live to better be able to control the buffer that we have in the tunnel system. When it comes to so my hopes for that is, of course, that in a few years that we'll have even more going live and hopeful also in the control system, actually, not on the desktop beside, but integrated in the overall monitoring. It's just one other way of monitoring. Mm-hmm. But I think it will take longer time than you would presume. And I think that's also with all artificial intelligence and machine learning. I think you should add quite a few years of the initial ambitions before you actually have something out there that is robust enough to stay with us for a long time in reality, so to speak. To sort of hire a data scientist, I don't see that, the next 5 years or so. I think the closest we get is to sort of hire someone who's really good at information management, which we're also working with in the production department. And that has to do with the technical documentation, and which becomes also more and more digital. And you're talking 3D, you're talking BIM and so on. I don't know how you, if you're used to that.
The BIM translates to me into building information modeling, right? Like the equivalent of a geographical information system just for a building, where you know which pipe is what, and you can really have a kind of live communication between the system and your physical. So if somebody sits with a tablet and looks at the pipe, then he already knows what is behind it, right? What attributes the pipe has and so on.
Exactly. You can sort of add on like augmented reality to that if you use the right tools and so on. I think that's the closest we're going to get in the coming years, to have someone working with that kind of information systematically. But we're going to hire engineers that has an interesting profile, and it could always be someone that's really into to data management as well. Mm-hmm. I don't see it as a challenge, but I mean, in the end, data quality never comes down to one person. It has to go the whole chain, from creating from the instrument and the maintenance of the instrument, from the signal processing and the storage in the databases, how you treat the averaging, how you do the calculations and checks, how you use the information in your everyday, and so on. So even if you hire a data scientist, that's just one brick in the game, really. And so I guess we will go for consultancy for that, for the heavy duty data science at the moment.
I would also say, so this my experience so far, so the tools that we need for the data, for that little brick from data science, in most cases are fairly simple. And I don't mean to say always, but in most cases you can use a fairly simple tool. And it's easier to train a domain expert in using that tool rather than picking up a data scientist that is not aware of the field of application and train them in that domain. So that's been my experience. Of course, it depends on the kind of project you try to do. If you're very close to practice, that I think that tends to be the case. In general, I would say that seems to be the tendency right now, is that you specialize in a certain domain of application and then tag on a few courses in data science and pick up the tools that way. Whereas I think it's a bit more difficult for a data scientist to then say, I'm going to pick one domain, and then that's going to be my investment for the next 5 years in really understanding that domain. I feel like that could ruin a data scientist's career in some sense.
As long as you don't want to get stuck in wastewater. It's a possibility.
Yeah, exactly. It's quite possible that people like it.
You never get stuck in wastewater. Like you thrive in wastewater.
Chris and Jörg, will you ever get out?
I won't.
Well, I'm kind of trying a little bit, I guess. I'm trying to keep the water in, actually. But where I'm at now, I'm working on energy distribution as well as additive manufacturing, so 3D printers and stuff like that. So it's fun. But that experience itself leads me to say this. It's a particular challenge for me to get into those domains. Mm-hmm. I look at the data, I don't understand it, and to really understand what's going on here. Oh, that's that. And so it takes time, it takes energy.
Are we talking about likelihood functions again, Chris?
No, not yet. It's really understanding how a three-phase high voltage line works and how a transformer works.
And yes. The data generating.
Long time ago, I had a course. Right? 20 years ago, I had a course on that, but not much of it stayed. So it's not impossible. I think it's just harder to move in that direction.
But still, I mean, if you combine efforts, and if we at the utilities are really good at picking up the problems that can be solved with the help of data science and combining efforts with someone that is really a good hacker or can use the databases and programming in the right way, I mean, that's when you can create something.
I think the worst thing one could do is hire a data science team and then being their own little department in an organization. I think that's the best kind of advice I feel like I've read, is that these people, when you hire them, have to be integrated in teams that don't have that expertise, so they can effectively learn from each other and tackle these issues together. Rather than those are the automation guys or those are the machine learning guys. We don't understand them. But every now and then they come back with a report. You know, that's the sort of the worst I think that could happen in any organization.
I think it's a similar, but what you say can also be applied to the people working with the instruments. I mean, they need to be close to understanding what the instruments are used for, and not only focusing on the instruments, but also understanding the reason why they're there. Hopefully, that means will be more fun, but also, I mean, you probably will do your job better if you do that.
Yeah, I think, and that some plants. I think you see So a sensor technician maybe takes a reference sample, a grab sample, to be analyzed in the lab. But the lab and the sensor technician kind of work so independently that, that you there's a missing piece of information. And that sort of integration between people that, again, don't really understand each other by default is I guess where you come in, you know, as a production manager. So, but that's again, that's hard work. It requires culture and culture management, I think, to make that happen.
It very much comes down to communication. That helps a lot, but it's as you say. I mean, it's it requires that you're also clear that you appreciate and need the quality of the data that these people are creating together. I mean, the lab, the technicians and engineers and so on.
Good.
Very good. Yeah. That sounds like almost sounds like a final statement, right? Like coming back from all the data, all the machines that we like to have in the future to communication and the human factor. That's wise stuff.
Maybe one last question, if I may, Jörg. Just to destroy this.
You must be used to this by now, Jörg.
Yeah, exactly. So I was curious, in your estimation, Linda, whether is the wastewater treatment business a unique business, or is it kind of the same like every other business? And the reason I'm saying is that the challenges that I see when it comes to data and control are somewhat the same, in my experience, across different disciplines. But I still think there could be something in wastewater treatment that is really unique and makes it stand out relative to other businesses. You have any sort of reflections on that?
I think we're less unique than we want to think. When it comes to the incentives and the effluent permits that we discussed a lot before, that stands out in an industrial point of view. I mean, many industries have permits, but they're also there for another reason than we are. So that's the driving force in our organizations that stands out a bit. And that means that, for instance, we really like redundancy a lot. Redundancy in equipment and so on, because we should always operate no matter what. Not all industries, but perhaps, well, depending on the cost, but prioritize that in a similar way. And now here at Chapella, we're also looking at actual redundancy in measurements when it comes to some really, really crucial samplers, for instance. We really want this information so much that we're actually putting down redundancy in there as well. But when it comes to data, I mean, data is structured. I mean, it doesn't matter where you pick data. If it's a wastewater treatment plant or somewhere else, you need a way to structure it, to collect it, to look for quality and so on. That's not unique by itself. Perhaps when it comes to control or automation, there are some differences. There are quite a few. There are not many control handles in a treatment plant compared to in other process industries, and we're quite slow. Things are not happening so quickly. We don't change things in a really high speed, and that also means that we have some safety margins sometimes when things doesn't work in control or in operations. So it actually helps us a bit that the processes are that slow. You can't really kill a big basin of bacteria in a few hours, even if you wanted to. maybe in process control there are some differences, but in data management, I mean, it comes down to how you organize yourself and how you prioritize, similar to many other places.
Great. So now that the topic of redundancy has come up, we can rightfully close.
Yes.
So,
like that should leave us all worried. Like, if Chris is starting to clone himself, like, beware, world.
Very good. So I think on that note, we'll close this main session. So thanks for listening in today. Thank you, Linda, for joining today. This was very useful, very interesting. And thanks, York, again, for being my co-instigator.
Thanks, Chris and MC, and thanks, Linda. It was awesome.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
And the Flush to Data podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Chris, Jorg, and their guest.
So,
good.
Like, it was really good. Yeah, there was like, maybe you can say like a little bit, did we miss something really important which we didn't cover, Linda?
No, I feel in a conversation like this, I mean, there's no list to check out on. I mean, we had a chat. And I mean, I don't feel that you're really missing something from that. So no.
Yes. Yeah. One point which I've been thinking, right? It's like if it's about data and models and digitization, I think like the first real-time control system on a sewer, which I know of, has been reported from the 1960s in the US, right? So it's like actuators and valves and real-time information being processed by a machine. So it's like 50 plus years of digitization, right? What we are talking about, intelligent systems, right? And what I've been wondering, what is really new maybe is this, let's say, machine-to-machine communication, right? In the 60s, you couldn't like send the data from your weather radar to your pump. You know, just like that was very difficult, I would say. Yeah. Like what now, like you get like a API from many different services, right? And then you can just connect things, right? And I've been wondering whether that is a topic where you could make a wish or like from your point of view, where you see a lot of potential.
I think that... I'm not sure I got your question right, but when it comes to machine-to-machine communication and transfer, I think it's unavoidable. And one of the areas I think this will be crucial is when it comes to cybersecurity, because there will be so many automated attacks going on to our even more automated society.
Mm-hmm.
Wastewater won't be standing out there. That the only way to sort of manage that is by other machines to counteract.
Mm-hmm.
That's just like that's what I'm expecting.
Yes, no human can like survey the sensor, like 2 million sensors in the Stockholm catchment area, right? That's
you can never be impossible. Protected from the development by the human eye.
Yes. What I was hinting at was more like, let's say, smart water meters, right? How many water is consumed in the industry or like in the Stockholm catchment, like, or what we are talking now to a mobile phone operator, which has developed an API. Like for other purpose, so you can get the number of people in a catchment on a, let's say, hourly basis, for example. You know, something like this, which was like simply not possible 10 years ago. Mm. Like, is there something where you say, oh, give me that figure and like my life is easy, you know, like I can go home?
No, not after this two-hour interview.
Yes. Okay.
No, I think a prognosis a better prognosis of the flow, which we're trying to work on at this stage, that will always help. That will always help, and I think we're going to get there. I mean, that's not rocket science. So that's just a matter of. Having the right input data and having the right models and just combine those. I did hear that you could actually use the mobile phone. How do you say the where the transmission they send out the radio
you mean transmission? You mean the commercial microwave links?
Is that what you call them?
Yes, that's what they call them. They're sensitive to rainfall, get a very detailed rainfall map in theory.
Exactly. Yes. So I think that would be something that we would like to use in the future.
Yes.
Because that's available, and just to combine that with the models, and that would be nice to see in practice.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they're hiring place at our chimney here to have their mobile connection. So yeah. I think they owe us that.
Yeah. Yes, that's very good. Yeah, no, honestly, right. It's like, I think it's nothing like, it's information which is being collected. It's one part of the 90% which is not being used, right? Not in the way it could be used.
Mm. And I mean, Jörg, you've been working a lot with rain sensors, I guess.
Yes, we've been trying that.
And it's really hard from us because the municipalities that are connected to us, they have a few rain sensors, but I'm not sure I will trust those to create a model. I would rather have other data sources. Especially, yes. We have something called snow, as you also know, in Switzerland. Yeah. But obviously, that's really, really, really hard to measure.
Snow is wicked. It's really, especially the melting like stuff, right? That's I can feel what you say.
And also you mentioned that automation has been going on for so many decades. I have expected that you would have solved measuring snow by now. Yeah.
Yes, it's often these conceptually easy problems than to be such a hard barrier, I find.
But the next step would sort of be, okay, so what kind of work at a treatment plant will be replaced by machines? That will be the question in the longer run, mm-hmm. as it is in the whole society. I mean, we've already automated quite a few things that was done 30 years ago by staff. So what will be the next step in that sense? I think it will, as I mentioned before, I think it will take much longer time than some people claim to make it work in real life. But I think you picked this up in this horizon scan that you made, didn't you?
Yes, a little bit. And it was not, the automation was not such a big thing, I think. And I don't know, if I look at my parents, right, like they were typewriting letters on a typewriter, you know, and they had to start like two times, three times, because you make an error and then your correction band doesn't work. I don't know whether the wastewater treatment plant, and now we have Word and we can like write 10 letters in the same time, maybe dictate it even, but on a wastewater treatment plant, they're still the same personnel than it was like in the 60s probably, right?
Like they're doing much. Do more things.
Yes, and I think if you tell me what's being replaced, I don't think it will be replaced substantially, right? Although I might be a bit optimistic. Like, of course, like everybody is working more and more crazy, right? It's more, we squeeze out so many more things of everybody, you know? So that might be like a hope from the digitization that we then in the future only work 20 hours or 30 hours per week. Like and like being like all the routine things like the like a spam filter, you know, all the not so important things is like pushed or automated, and the rest is really like landing on your plate, and you still have time to do the other important things in your life, right?
Yeah, so. No, I agree with that perspective. I do. I mean, we will be we don't know when, but we will be doing treatment of pharmaceutical residues, mm-hmm. Because we've had that from the authorities that we're obliged to look into that and later on also build it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a new, complete new process step, new for us, new technology, even though it's, of course, tested already around the world. But do we actually need more staff for that, or can we do things smarter instead? That's something we will see.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and one thing I think which I would like to have talked about is the integration, right? Like on the one hand, of course, integration of wastewater treatment plant and sewers. You say you operate a tunnel, so you have an inflow model. You are interested in rainfall in principle, which many treatment plant operators are not at all. Like, so what potential do you see there?
To combine the plant mm-hmm. and the sewers, and also maybe the ecology in yes. the end. No, I think that will keep developing. I mean, there's initiatives there on research already. Mm-hmm. So I think, I mean, we're working on a process model to keep developing that in mm-hmm. in the plant side, and combining that with an infant model. That's something we can approach quite soon, I think, and people mm-hmm. are already doing that at other places.
Yes.
So I mean, that's possible. It's only. Of course, there's technical challenges, sort of combining states between the models. What states should become these new states in the new model, and so on. Do we have all the measurements that you need, or do you need to sort of invent some states as mm-hmm. as the water comes into the plant, and so on? But I mean, that's one of the decision tools that you can really use, and also as I mean, something that you learn really early on, that modeling, it can be used for training. But I mean, if you're going towards even more advanced plants with mm-hmm. with more advanced processes, at the same time we do have a shift in staff from people that have been working for many years that really knows that the plant, if you wake them up in the middle of the night, they know which button to push, so yeah. to speak. And there's a new generation coming on who's going to have to train to learn the plant. And I think models really can play a role. We can be better at that, using mm-hmm. the models for training.
As a communication device.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm talking about shifting domains, Chris. The people shifting yeah. towards our domain. Oh, exactly. They need a model.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But again, one of the challenges there, at least wastewater treatment, maybe less so elsewhere, those models as we have them are not perfect. And so you have a tool that is useful but not perfect. And then having that sort of feel for how far you can trust the tool, you know, how far you can extrapolate, how far you can, you know, because some of the biokinetic models are now getting quite detailed with different groups of nitrifiers and different groups of phosphor accumulating organisms and stuff like that. And you can, you have so many parameters you calibrate, but then when you start to, let's say, use that model to study the process, can you really manipulate those parameters and say, oh, what's the effect of that? What's the effect of that? And then trust that your conclusion will make sense. I think that's, again, for that, you need that, I think, experience and sort of
you have that, for instance,
in the real world and one leg in the virtual world.
Yeah. You have an example in the anaerobic digestion models. Which you don't really just, well, they're hard to sort of, they're not so transparent.
No, they're not.
So if you're going to use them in the real world, you really need to work on how you ground that in your organization, and what's the domain for that model.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I was talking to one of our instrumentation engineers just the other day, and I was asking, so how is it going with the manufacturers? Will they be able to provide a phosphate analyzer that can actually go down to the concentrations that we want? Well, we're discussing 0.05 now, and it's a real challenge for them. I'm also thinking that actually for a model to model correctly around 0.05 in phosphate with the data availability that we have, that will also be challenging, no matter whether it's data driven or if it's a physically based model or whatever. So it also comes down to the permit again, because that's what's driving us towards those concentrations.
So I wanted to check a small technical thing. You said you are now investing in redundant measurements. So that redundancy is you basically have the same device in the same location. Like you said, you have samplers, so you have a same sampler or a duplicate sampler in the same location.
Exactly. That's on the sampling side where we want to never miss a sample. Because, I mean, samplers, they break or you misprogram them. I mean, you have the human factor, and we just wanted, we've experienced that. We wanted to have like a redundancy also there. Yes.
So you would have them both working at the nominal rate, or do you sort of program them as being alternating sampling?
I think they're I'm not sure actually. I know that they're operating at the same location, but I don't know how they actually solve the programming. I just know that they're going to solve the problem that we might have, that we're losing a sample. I'm not sure how they do the filling and rotation and so on.
Well, that's fascinating. I'd be very curious to see how repeatable the sampling and measurement procedure is, you know, because that's, you know.
I don't think they do the analysis. They only make analysis of one of the samples so far, at least. But yeah, when you do lab comparisons between labs, and you see that. Again, you cannot trust the measurements.
Yeah, I relate to that. One person once told me, if you have one sensor, you have no problem. But if you have two sensors, you have problems all the time. And so I'd be very curious to. So in your case, what you solved is the access to a sample, right? But once you started measuring both samples that are available at the same time or approximate at the same time, that will make your Friday meeting maybe more interesting.
Maybe we have to sort of use the Schrodinger's cat or something in this problem.
Yeah.
Do we actually want to check if the cat is there?
Exactly. Sure. Because that person was like, don't do that. Don't put...
No.
Two sensors in the same spot, because you're only causing trouble.
and that's also what happened. I mentioned that we had this study going on comparing sensors and wanting to. It's the fault detection studies that Oscar also has been working with, and there was like three sensors trying to make the same measurement. And I mean, you really get confused rather than helped from it.
Yes.
And it's like having like these portable reference sensors, putting them down. What do they actually, and like for the solvation, for instance, or sludge concentration? I mean, what do they say? Tell you?
Yes, to get some value. Yeah. That's interesting. And we also in an internal meeting had a joke on the Schrödinger's. It was a Schrödinger's fish this time, with either dead or not dead. But like, if nobody looks, you know, then like, has there been pollution or not? Like, we don't know. Yes.
Yeah. That brings me back to the sewer aging stuff that you did, I think with Andrea Scheidegger, where a pipe gets replaced, let's say in a sewer network.
Yes.
But then all the data from the previous pipe that ruptured or that broke is gone. So don't know. You don't know if it was ruptured or broken, or it was just a replacement due to, you know, had reached a certain age and therefore needed to be. So, and then you had to do a specialized Bayesian modeling to account for the missing data, I think, or just something like that. Yeah.
Yes, it's like there are people who only record the data from their pumping stations every 15 minutes, and then you have to lead a sophisticated model to back calculate the flow, right? Like, you can just switch on the logging interval differently and record every 30 seconds, and then you can do a mass balance, basically, you know. Yes.
All right.
That was a very good conversation. Like, do we have a wish for us in research, Linda? Like, what should we give you? Better sensors, better models, or better people?
I remember one of your previous guests, Peter. He said at one, I think it was on like the Watermatics conference somewhere, somehow. He said that we should stop developing new models and focus on using the ones that we have. I don't remember which year this was, but it was interesting to come from someone like Peter, who's really into developing models. I think that what you're doing already, trying to have one leg at one side and keeping close to reality, that's good enough for picking up what's coming and focusing in how to implement and make it work. Keep working with the quality and improving that, both in terms of the quality of data and measurement, of course, but also in quality in use, how you can actually verify that it's working, the models, for instance. And of course, yeah, developing good sensors for us, that's also always on the wish list, but that's...
I think Peter has worked, just to put Peter on the spot without option for recourse, but I think he's violated
that. I'm sure he has.
So I think he developed a few settling models that are updated since then.
I choose not to.
He might have referred to the ASM model, the biokinetic models.
I chose not to bring that up, but you did, Chris. So now,
Now it's set. It's documented. Set in stone.
Exactly.
No, but I remember that when Peter said that, because there's a truth in it also. I mean, you can always work on in the margin and improving, but we need to get it out there. Yeah.
I think one sense that I got from that time is that there was a lot of effort, including from his group in Belgium, on parameter estimation and biokinetic models. And the community, I think the wastewater treatment modeling community, came to the realization that while fiddling with those kinetic parameters, we really shouldn't do. We need to understand the equipment better, the aeration equipment. We need to understand influence generation better. And then that spurred a lot of work, I think, in having more detailed models of the aeration equipment, having more detailed influence generated models to use for benchmarking and simulation.
And it also put a bit focus on having an idea of the influent wastewater instead of fiddling around with the parameters.
Yeah.
So putting the focus in the right spot. I think from my point of view, I think that's been really useful, because there's so many degrees of freedom. There's so many things to vary that you can end up with so many solutions in different, the same solutions with different ways of doing it, mm-hmm. or different combinations of settings and so on.
Very good. So we'll have to bring Peter back and hold his feet to the fire.
we collect a couple of points models. More like that.
Very good. I don't think we have a record of that original Watermatics point, but I do remember him saying that, yeah. He said it a few times. Yeah. Good.
Good.
Yeah. That was fun.
Yeah.
So.
I like your hobby. Good. It's really nice to be part of it for today.
Well, thanks for taking your time. That was really awesome. Yeah, exactly. It's like a world which both of us don't really know, right? So it's like, it's very cool. And I guess our listeners are also like, if you made it to minute 90 almost, then you're with us. Like, very good. I think our listeners will appreciate it.
If you made it to minute 90, maybe you should join us and identify yourself as a future guest.
Yes. Yeah, we can have a prize somewhere. Very good. Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, thanks, Jörg. Thanks, Linda, for joining.
Thanks,
today.
Linda. That was awesome.
It was really interesting. Yeah.
Thanks a lot, both of you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.